giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody. This is the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. It is October 12th. I am Ben Orenstein, and I am here with William Josephson and Jay Murthy. How's it going, guys?
Great. Thanks.
You guys are from Solano Labs, makers of Tedium. Is that right?
That's right.
So the classic question you have to ask for new companies is to get the elevator pitch. So what do you want to tackle that?
Sure. So Tedium is about bringing massively scalable, easy to use, painless continuous integration to everybody. Even small startups, even extremely large organizations, we can scale from the smallest little app to real production systems that, you know, take hours and hours to test on a laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And we can make people much, much happier in the process of building their software and making really great work.
Awesome. So you're speeding up tests. It's continuous integration. It's parallelized. They're going faster. I saw on your site that you guys are just crossed 14 million tests run.
That's right. We're actually getting close to 15 million.
Yeah.
And 10 million was just a few weeks ago. So it's picking up the pace.
Yeah, yep. Picking up the pace big time.
Excellent. So can you give me sort of a rough idea of like what the architecture looks like behind the service?
Sure. So there's actually a lot of things in the stack that should be familiar to, you know, a lot of the people who are listening to this. There's a Rails application that's serving, you know, much of the user interface and actually some of the backend control. The user interface is implemented, you know, partially using pretty standard Rails views, mm-hmm. And then a backbone application for real-time updating. In the guts of things, we use a mix of Postgres and Redis. Most of the real-time updates, all of the test results coming back, all of the kind of real-time build flow,
mm-hmm.
the queuing system, that's all implemented based on Redis. And we use Postgres as a permanent backing store. After, you know, a build has settled down, it gets flushed back into Postgres. And we use Postgres for other transactional types of things like account management.
Mm-hmm.
One interesting thing that we've been doing a little bit more recently is instead of optimizing things with C extensions, we've actually been using Go web services to pull out little bits of critical path, high performance aspects of the system. We've been actually having a lot of great success with testing the Go web services with Ruby code.
You build a little web service in Go, and then you write some Cucumber features around it or something like that. And we found that that's a really great way to test, because what you're looking for a lot of times is kind of more of an integration or end-to-end test, and the tools in Ruby are just really much better for that sort of thing than they are in a lot of other communities.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what's an example of the kind of thing that is critical path that you can speed up by writing one of these Go services?
So, I mean, one thing is that we have, you know, if you want to talk to, you have a set of virtual machines that everybody's running on, and when you want to talk to those virtual machines or make calls into your whatever your service provider is for provisioning and so on. Go is a great fit for that because it can manage a lot of concurrency very naturally in a way that's a little bit more challenging to do with Ruby. Mm-hmm. Ruby is really great where you need extensibility, where you want to add features quickly. But if you want to have 10,000 connections outstanding, you can do that with something like Event Machine, and you know that's certainly one way to go. But you can kind of preserve a natural threaded model with Go and handle that kind of massive concurrency pretty easily.
Excellent. So we sort of stopped before we got to the sort of the guts. Like, where are the tests running?
Uh-huh.
Is this proprietary? Can we talk about this?
It's not proprietary, but we don't actually tie ourselves to a particular provider necessarily, but we run them, you know, quote unquote, in the cloud.
Mm.
So we use a public cloud provider. Much of that actually is run now in Amazon Web Services.
Mm-hmm.
Which should
never heard of
surprising
them.
Really anybody.
That's not a surprise. But I mean, one of the things that for us is that we're kind of cloud agnostic. We're not tied specifically to Amazon. They've done very well for us. I mean, that's been a being able to kind of scale rapidly with them is obviously a benefit to a lot of businesses that Ruby people are building. But we do specifically made a design choice not to integrate so deeply with Amazon that we couldn't move elsewhere, if that made sense.
Mm. And have you used that ability yet, or is that just sort of a maybe someday kind of thing?
In a limited manner, yes. What it comes down to is just the flexibility of being able to deploy quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to do that in a way that we can actually control the environment.
Pretty closely. Having that as a design goal enforces a certain discipline on you. So you make sure you separate concerns in the right way.
Right.
You know, so that even if you never end up actually using the fact, although as Jay said, we do a little bit, it's a useful coding discipline.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, yeah. I have a nice abstraction layer.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah. I gave a talk recently and I mentioned something like this, which is when I'm working with external services, I'll almost always write like an intermediate layer.
Right.
And not because I'm pretty sure we're going to switch it, although it makes it easier if we do, but because it gives you other benefits.
Right.
It's like easier to stub that service out. You know, you don't end up with like these implementation details in your own code.
Yeah, and actually stubbing it out is a great example because there are a lot of things where you want to be able to write a unit test or a functional test, and you don't want to have to go and spin up a whole lot of virtual machines in Amazon. And, you know, there are some people who've been, you know, spinning up virtual boxes locally to do that kind of testing. And that's reasonable, and there may be some great reasons to do it, but it's heavyweight. And so if you can just stub out a lot of that stuff and you have the abstraction layer to make that kind of feasible, that's a big deal.
Right. Mm.
Cool. So can you guys share how many paying customers you have these days?
A few hundred.
Okay. Excellent.
Put it that way.
Yeah. Good. So going well.
Yeah, it's going well. It's growing. It's definitely making people happy, which is kind of what it's set out to do. And, you know, the feedback that we've received has been more or less universally positive, right? People are just super happy that they don't have to set up another Jenkins box or put a Mac Mini in the corner and do this thing. And we
or
actually
20 Mac Minis, 20
Mac Minis
in the corner.
Right.
You know, if you have a build that takes 4 hours and you kind of wish it would go in 10 minutes,
we can do that for
we
you.
Do that.
Cool.
We have done that.
Yeah. Excellent. So what's been the biggest surprise so far in running this company?
I mean, one of the things that's fascinating to me, both of us come from a storage background and we've worked at large companies, ones that took, you know, a lot of capital to get off the ground, and things like Amazon have just changed the face of startups. There are just so many interesting startups you can build, and so many of our customers are building with Ruby, that you can kind of start with something like Heroku, Engine Yard, or just straight on Amazon, and the upfront capital expenditure is so much lower that they're just the time from idea to some execution is so much smaller. I think that's really exciting.
Mm-hmm. And the time from that execution to first customers to real feedback and sort of, you know, this iterative process of building and delivering software is, you know, it's something that I'd experienced in a sort of different setting, but it's actually really awesome to see how fast it goes.
Mm. And I think the other thing that's interesting is we kind of go back and talk to people in the storage industry that some of these ideas around how to do testing and to do, you know, how to do iteration and so on have been adapted for the storage industry. They're different. They're not doing a 1 week sprint or a 2 week sprint. You're doing a 1 month sprint or a 6 week sprint because you're dealing with hardware and, you know, it's different. But at the same time, there's a recognition that what's going on in the Ruby community and in the, you know, the Web 2.0 community is real innovation in how to manage products and build software products. Mm-hmm. And so seeing that kind of go back into some of the storage industry is kind of interesting because they're very late adopters of things like this.
Right. They're very conservative, but you know, you look at the major applications that everybody uses on a day-to-day basis, and they're complex machines, right? They're large software systems. Most of them are running on hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of cores, right? Lots and lots of computers are serving Twitter and Facebook and Google. And these are not, you know, it's not the kind of simple application, but the same frameworks and the same, you know, ways of building these pieces of software scales up and down.
Yeah, and so you see people in financial services, you see people in storage, you see people all over the place talking about using the same terminology, using the same process, and getting a lot of the same benefit. Right. It's kind of neat.
Hmm. So you guys said that your background is sort of in storage and hardware and things like that. So were either of you Rails developers before you started this company?
No.
Wow, interesting.
We actually hadn't ever written any Ruby.
No Ruby. And you started a company targeted at Ruby developers.
Yep.
Did that concern you? Does it concern you now?
Nope.
I don't think so. I mean, it's been interesting. There's a vibrant community around Ruby, no matter where you go. So, you know, we've obviously spent a lot of time here in Boston and out in San Francisco. But we went to Ruby Midwest last fall, and there's a good community there. And I think with that kind of community, and a community that's willing to reach out and say, here's how we think about problems, here's what's interesting to us, mm-hmm. and a bunch of smart people, the transition wasn't too painful. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a learning curve, but we've all done that with Rails, no matter how we started with it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And how are you making sure that you are building something that people want if you're not building it for yourself?
Well, there are two answers to that. One, we are building it for ourselves. We dog food like crazy. I think that's really important. If there's some products where it doesn't make sense, but if it makes sense, you got to be dog fooding it. But because you're kind of your own worst critic in some ways, or best critic, depending on how you look at it. But I think the other thing is that we just like to get out there and talk to people. We spend a lot of time talking to customers. We like to hear feedback. We don't always hear things we want to hear, but the things we need to hear. And so we're really eager to hear what the community is doing, where they're going, how they're thinking about testing software quality, and figuring out how to make TDM a better product.
And how to make it serve the needs of this community in a better way. I think,
you can't do it in a vacuum, I guess, is a large part of the answer.
Right.
I mean, that's why we came up to ThoughtBot, and we started off talking with Dan, but kind of one of our first questions is, would you use this? And if you would use it, how would you use it? What would make you interested in using it?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the answer is different for different people, right? There's the guy with the 10,000 line Heroku app who says, I've got 3 devs or 2 devs, and I just don't want to deal with the pain of setting up CI, but I need it. And then there's the 80 or 90 person or 100 person engineering organization in a company of 300 or 400 or 500 people, and they say, we've got a 4 or 5, 6 hour build. We can't do our business if we don't have this. And they're just there's a lot of overlap, maybe more than I expected, but then they're also different use cases too.
Right. So we were working together for a while. Can you talk about what that engagement was?
Sure. I think there've been several. Jay.
Sure. So there have been a number of neat little projects. The first one was actually just the first touch of nice CSS.
Mm. Yeah.
and actually Galen was working on that. And he did a great job. And then the next project was actually our GitHub API integration. So you can sign in via GitHub and automatically configure all of your GitHub repos to build, pretty seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
Click, 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 and they come up and they build. A lot of that work is actually done by both Galen and John.
Mm-hmm. Galen Frischetta and John Urich.
And John Urich.
Yep. Awesome. Good experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've had a great experience. I think it's not easy to just kind of drop into an unfamiliar code base and be pretty immediately productive and have useful ideas about the product too. Maybe it's a little different because it's a technical product, so kind of ThoughtBot's also a customer, but kind of thoughtful feedback is almost as valuable as the engineering talent for us. ThoughtBot's done this sort of thing before, and has a lot of useful things to say.
Yeah, and that's actually that's totally one of the type of project we look for, is something where we can contribute beyond just code.
Right.
It's like something we think we could have useful opinions on and offer useful feedback,
right,
as opposed to just like taking a set of requirements, thrown over the wall, and code it up and give it back to you.
Right.
Right.
And we tend not to really work that way. In the same sort of vein of, making sure that what we're building is what people want.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to, we like to iterate closely and get feedback from everybody involved, right? It's not my way or the highway.
We've learned a lot from our
customers
too. Get
this done and make it useful, and incorporate everything that you can to make it as useful as it can be.
Hmm. So I think one of your competitors in this space would be somebody like Travis CI. Is that true?
Yeah, sure. Travis has been traditionally much more focused on the open source community than we have, and I think that's great. I think it's having that facility is important to the community. I mean, things like Rails itself needs continuous integration, and we're not that's not something we're doing, but we also we are thinking about ways to give back to the community through open source software, and also through offering public builds. That's not something that we currently do, but it's, you know, it's on the roadmap.
Certainly. Mm. How do CI services differentiate themselves? Like how do you?
I mean, there are a number of things. One of the things that we offer that really nobody else offers is massive scale. We can offer people really a high performance experience that nobody else is really in the position to do. And that's kind of where we use our, you know, leverage our background is in building large scale distributed systems with that are high performance.
And what does massive scale translate into for me?
So you know, for a smaller customer who's got a small Heroku app, a small team, it means, you know, it's bulletproof. And I think, you know, that certainly the Travis folks have done a good job there too. But that's certainly a value that we add as well. If you look at a large build, you know, a multi-hour build, it's not a trivial thing to get that to run in 5 or 10 minutes, and that's what a lot of our customers come to us for.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, yeah. there's a problem to solve there in bringing hardware to bear, bringing the right resources to bear, and actually, you know, actually making it fast.
Mm-hmm. Right. And if you just throw hardware at it, it's going to be too expensive even for a deep-pocketed customer. So it has to be done carefully. You know, you have to have the right algorithms, the right infrastructure, the right
Do you have complicated strategies for splitting a test suite in order to achieve performance? Is that where the wins are coming?
There's a combination of hardware and kind of intelligence monitoring of people's builds.
Cool. So you guys have a Heroku add-on?
We do.
Has that been a significant source of customers or revenue?
It has been. It's actually been a great source of, you know, it's been a great source of customers. It's actually been a great source of feedback.
Hmm.
And it was actually one of the earliest launches that we did was with Heroku's platform and elsewhere. But actually a lot of the folks who are using TDM via the Heroku add-on, they have, you know, really smooth, painless experiences.
Hmm.
Right? Because their applications tend to be already tooled to fit into Heroku's platform.
Right.
And our platform is more or less exactly compatible with what you would get from Heroku.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually works out well for everybody involved. Mm. Because the users have a good experience, we have a good experience, and everybody's happy.
Mm. Great. So what has worked and not worked for getting people to the site?
That's a great question.
Thanks.
It's the perennial startup problem, right? You need to get people to just look at you in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And once they do that, you need to capture their attention and actually provide them some value. You know, we're talking about engineers, developers, designers, engineering managers here who are the customers of this product. And, you know, they don't really suffer BS.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be straight and to the point. It's got to be, you know, there has to be a pretty clear value. It has to be easy for them to try it. I think some of the experimentation initially came around pricing. You know, people.
But that doesn't get people there.
It doesn't get people there.
What gets people to the homepage? What's worked for that?
I mean, there are a number of things. We've put together a screencast that's already on the website. We've got some more videos kind of keyed up to come out over the next several weeks and months. And I think people really do respond to that. It gives them a kind of an easy way to see what's going on in 30 seconds. And
once they're there.
Right.
Once they're there. But I think,
Set me one step back. So I've never heard of you before. How do I hear about you?
Ultimately, content is king.
Okay.
Right. So we've put up Google Ads and search engine optimization type of things. And those actually drive a decent amount of traffic. Mm-hmm. But the interesting, you know, interesting blog posts, interesting conversations we've had. We do a lot of meetups. We go to a lot of conferences. You know, we like to meet people.
Mm.
And
we like to hear about what their problems are and talk to them. And that always works well. Twitter has been a place where people kind of, you know, share their experiences about the service. And then, you know, that we certainly see new people come to the website as a result of their friends tweeting about it. But
gotcha.
You know, there's certainly the blog posts are important. We've when interesting things happen in the company, we try to write up, you know, something about it. We see, you know, one thing was, when do people commit? You know, that was kind of an interesting question for us. When are people working? You know, and
mm-hmm.
And you see different working patterns, and you can very quickly see who's a 9-to-5 shop and who's a a lean mean startup and so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we've written blog posts about that. They kind of get shared around. And, so yeah, it's kind of the usual smattering of things. You know, we sponsor events here in Boston and we've done some in San Francisco too.
Gotcha. Are you running any A/B tests at the moment?
Yes, but not in the traditional A/B test type of model. Right? Okay. So we're not splitting users at random. We do more, I think, methodical limited rollouts. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of the limited rollouts have to do with, you know, platform software that, you know, it's less to do with, you know, for example, the response of a user to a layout of an application or of a, you know, kind of form of text or, you know, something like that to a design, and mm-hmm. more to do with actually validating correctness of things for, you know, particularly advanced users or people who are,
you know, exactly. A lot of people come in kind of an early access to new features.
Yeah, so you have you're running a beta for JRuby support, for example.
Yeah, there's a private beta for JRuby support. We've certainly done the same thing for new testing frameworks, and, you know, new software packages. We've got people who, you know, say somebody needs a new scientific library. You know, that was one that came up not that long ago. Mm. Certainly, we'll roll that out to a small select group who clearly have a need and a use for it, and then. Before we kind of generally announce it. So there's, that, there's certainly kind of, certainly things like feature keys are a big part of it. And that's in part because we don't want to disrupt the workflow of users who are using the system on a regular basis and don't need the new feature yet. So why put it in their day-to-day workflow until we've had a few people who need the new feature, who really kind of vetted and banged on and said, yeah, that's great.
Makes sense. And then, so you guys have a free trial?
You do.
We do, yeah.
Do you know roughly what percent of people are signing up after the free trial?
It's a decent conversion rate. Mm-hmm. I don't think we want to share specific numbers, okay. But it's, you know, we're pretty happy with it.
Are you?
You know, obviously, it's something we
track pretty closely, but, obviously, yeah. And, yep. And you know, we do think hard about how we can improve that. What when somebody comes in and they use it, I really want to know why they use it. When they come in and they say, you know, this isn't for me, I want to know why. So yeah. You know, we definitely talk to customers pretty
cool.
Pretty
have there been any lessons from there, like things you've done that have resulted in a noticeable bump there?
The main lesson there is to remove thought from the process. Mm-hmm. Right. The more people have to ponder and decide and sort of evaluate choices or, you know, decisions that they have to make, or for example, you know, failed builds that they have to fix.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we've seen certainly is that we now have enough users. You know, there are 1,000 developers or more using the platform on a daily basis. We've got a lot of users. Jay was talking about a number of kind of accounts, but there's, you know, you can have 100 developers under a single account.
Mm-hmm.
So you got thousands of people using it on a daily basis, and they're using a lot of different gems, and they're using things in kind of unexpected ways. And so what you end up seeing is you see that, you know, certain versions of certain gems have bugs in them. That, you know, bugs happen, right? You can test as much as you want, you're still going to have them.
Mm-hmm.
What we can do is, you know, we can recognize that in somebody's application that they have a problematic gem before they even run their tests. Like they send us their gem file. They send us their gem file .lock. We can look and we can say, you know, this may have been working for you, but you might actually have a problem. You might really want to upgrade this gem or this version of this gem. We've seen a lot of problems with that and this other gem. And so, you know, you're asking about conversion rates. Being able to do that is actually really valuable. It's great for retention because it you know, delivers value. I mean, people actually like that. It's actually
sure.
useful.
Yeah.
But it also is helpful for driving conversions because, you know, when people have the natural reaction when you're using a new service is, it must be their bug because it works for me locally.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually see that. You see that more with tests too, because, you know, just like the rest of the community, we use a Mac for a lot of what we do. But most people are deploying to Linux. And it turns out that there are certain things in your test suite that work on a Mac and don't work under Linux. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that there's a bug in your application. It means actually that there's just some dependencies in your test suite on the fact that you're under Linux. Or in other cases, it can actually be a real fault that you just have been fortunate not to hit. And so, you know, a simple example is if you're using RSpec, people will put a whole bunch of support things under spec support, under the spec support directory, and they expect to load they actually have order dependencies in the way that the order that those files are loaded.
Uh-huh.
And there are differences in the semantics for Linux and macOS on that. You know, macOS sorts those for you, Linux doesn't.
Mm.
So, you know, they'll run their tests in TDM where everything's running under Linux and things won't work, and they'll say, you know, no, TDM must be broken. And so being able to detect that that's a problem and automatically say, you know, you need to make sure you have a well-defined load order here.
Mm. Giving people the tools to actually, you know, notice that on their own, prompt them in the right way, and actually, you know, solve that problem on their own.
Yeah.
Is actually
that sounds powerful. How do you detect that? Do you look for, like, you've defined this method twice in these set of files?
There are a bunch of things. You know, depends on how deep an analysis you want to do. You know, some things you can just find with grep, basically. And there, mm-hmm. there are other things where you need to actually, you know, look at the code a little bit and do a little bit of static analysis. And we can do that.
Okay. And do you run some automatic checks like that? Or is this sort of you investigate when the builds aren't working?
We usually do those automatically.
Yeah, I mean, so those things need to be automatic because, you know, like Jay said, we love going out and talking to customers, but, you know, we can't do that every minute of the day for every customer, and they don't want it. They really want the thing to work,
mm-hmm.
and they want to be self-sufficient. They want to be able to say, oh, here's a message that says, you know, here's an article I can read, and I'll go fix it myself. They don't necessarily want us in the loop. I mean, they're like coming and learning stuff from us, but then on the day-to-day, they just want... You want to be able to be automatic and have that quick turnaround that a computer can deliver.
And, you know, oftentimes we actually get interesting suggestions of those types of warnings from our customers.
Mm.
You know, it's everybody is kind of pushing on the latest. You know, they're, you know, new releases of gems, they're new releases of testing environments, testing frameworks.
Yeah, I mean, and just last week I was working with a guy who's bringing up Rails 4, and he's, you know, he's had some challenges with logging in Rails 4. I think they're well understood and been fixed now, but, you know, people are always kind of pushing the envelope, and so there's that natural dialogue there. And then some of the early adopters kind of, we work with some of the early adopters to give them a good experience, and then, you know, larger engineering organizations that have to be a little bit more conservative just because that's a requirement of their business. It's a large business. They come to us and say, "Well, what, you know, what are other customers doing? What other people seeing?" And so, there's an opportunity also for us to say, you know, we don't even look at people's code unless they sign an NDA with us or tell us they can't or we can. But we do have kind of software looking at their software to help them. And then in some cases, we talk with customers. They say, you know, do you know another customer who's facing this problem? And we can go, and if that's another customer that we know well, that we know has that problem, we can say, do you want to talk to somebody? And it's kind of a matchmaking, a dating service for this sort of thing, where we're very careful because we don't want any, you know, we don't tell people who our customers are. We don't really, you know.
We're very cognizant of people's privacy.
But at the same time, there are customers that kind of want to be able to connect with somebody else who has a similar problem and understand how they solved it.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about sort of support that you're doing. How big is the support burden on you guys?
It's, you know, it's been really reasonable. I think one of the things that it goes back to having the computer do a lot of this sort of thing for us, you know, being able to identify problems automatically so that we're not spending as much time on support, certainly, but also because it means that people get immediate feedback.
Right.
And they get feedback in the right place at the right time. And so we make an effort to automate where we can. And then, you know, to provide the high level of service, human interaction where it's necessary.
Hmm. So what does success look like for TDM? What would you love to see happen?
I mean, there are a lot of things I'd love to see happen over, you know, in the fullness of time. I think what we see now is, you know, obviously more people in the Ruby community using the service. That's always great. Growth is always great. I think what we're seeing is a lot of people who are using Ruby are also using other technologies, you know, and so supporting a wider range of those technologies as well, so that you know, that we can support those same organizations as they grow and adopt new technology.
Hmm. I think the, you know, success is achieving that goal of bringing these types of, you know, basically bringing the software development methodology that CI enables to more and more people,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, making that available in a way that's easy for, you know, easy for them to use, that allows us to, you know, do something interesting.
So if all goes well, would you want to hire a couple support people and then go hang out on the beach? Is that the eventual model? Is like, you know,
I don't think you start a company if your goal is to hang out on the beach. not that there's anything wrong with the beach, but I don't think that's what people do.
Yeah.
You know, if you start in the company, I think that there's a lot of interesting technology still to build, even, you know, to make Tedium better. So there are a lot of interesting challenges.
Yep. Yet
to solve. So if you had 20,000 customers, what would you be doing?
I'd be looking for 80.
What?
I'd be looking for 80,000.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, sure. I think with 20,000 customers, there are a lot of things you can do. I think one of the things I'd like to see happen in the Ruby community is somebody who can help people understand what gems they should be using. The one thing that there's less of in the Ruby community that some other communities have, and I think can be an advantage in the right circumstances, is a corporate sponsor for around some of the core pieces. You know, I think the open source ethos is great. I think that having the Rails core team doing what they do is great. I think that as a user of Ruby, kind of knowing, having a little more insight into which gems are best suited for a particular task, you know, kind of, I can go ask on Stack Overflow, I can go ask at the boston.rb, but I got to go out and ask. I wish there were kind of a central repository for that sort of thing, and I think something like Tedium can do that, because it's with a lot of users, you can kind of say, well, these are the things that work, these are the things that don't.
Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see a breakdown of, like, probability of a broken build given a certain gem appears in your gem
like
file.
I mean, I don't, you know, we've done some of that sort of analysis. I don't know.
Ooh, what's the worst?
No, I mean, I don't think we have.
That'd be a good blog post, right?
It would be a great blog post. I think, you know, the fact of the matter is, I mean, I know that, I think it's more the probability of a broken build given this gem and this particular version of that gem. Because,
right.
You know, there's some really useful, important gems out there, like Nokogiri would be an example. And there was a version that broke a couple of customers.
Specific version.
With a very specific version. It was quickly fixed. And so it's not like, oh, you know, this isn't a good gem. It's a great gem. But, you know, knowing that this version is not so great.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a concrete example. We have a number of customers. You're asking kind of things that improve conversion. Well, we had a lot of customers who came in and they had done a bundle install initially, locally, and they pushed it to Tedium and it couldn't install the bundle. And they said, you know, what's up? And it turns out some of the gems in their bundle had been yanked and they didn't know it. And the reason they've been yanked is because there were bugs that needed to be fixed.
But they had local copies of
them. They had local copies of it, so they never noticed. And so they had that out in production. You know, a way to say, here's my bundle. Is everything kind of, are there any known serious problems out there that I should be aware of? It's not like bad gem versus good gem. It's bad version versus good version.
Totally.
You know,
that could be useful.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Awesome. I think that actually wraps things up. It's about all the questions I had for you guys. But thank you very much for coming by and chatting with me. It's been great.
Yeah.
So it was our pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So a couple events I want to mention coming up. The first is Mike Burns is giving a talk called The Expression Problem on October 30th at the Riga Ruby Group in Latvia. I'll be speaking at RubyConf November 1st through 3rd in Denver. Will I see you guys there?
I don't think so.
I think not, probably. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay.
We have
Sarah them. Says yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Yes.
So I'll see you there.
Yeah.
Excellent. So I'm giving a talk called Refactoring from Good to Great. I'm going to be doing a lot of live coding. Hopefully everything will work out all right. If you're going to be there, come say hi.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, Chad Pytel will be giving a talk at Software Craftsmanship North America, November 9th through 11th. He's going to be talking about Apprentice.io and important lessons learned. Now, if you want to get the notes and links from the things we've talked about at the podcast, you can go to thoughtbot.com/podcast/16. This is our 16th podcast. So, guys, if somebody wanted to try Tedium, how would they get in touch with you? What's the website?
They can go to solanolabs.com or tddium.com, and you can find us on Twitter at at Solano Labs or at TDDIUM.
And how do you spell Solano?
S-O-L-A-N-O.
Awesome. Anything else you want to plug while we're here?
If you have any JRuby apps that you'd like to test, we're open to beta requests for JRuby.
Awesome. And how will we get in touch with you guys specifically?
Just go to the website, and there should be a landing page for you to click on.
Now, often on the podcast, we'll take some time to answer your questions. If you have something you'd like us to tackle on the air, you can email your question to info@thoughtbot.com or tweet to us @thoughtbot. Today's podcast was recorded by Shauna Quintal, edited by Edward Lovell, and produced by Chad Pytel. Thanks for listening.